ethnic setup was, for example, the Slavonic people were designated to Rockstown. The Italian people were designated to Plan 11.
Who designated?
The corporations built this town and built the houses. And had they built the houses, when you applied for a house, they gave you a house in this particular section, and you rented from them at that particular time. And they took the rent out of your pay. We also had in this town a company store in which you bought all your stuff, and many, many of our employees would receive no money at all, because the time they paid their rent, the time they paid for the voting and booting, and there was nothing to see people go and get their pay envelope and get three X's on their pin envelope with no money at all.
You started to say about the political party here.
Yeah, well, this was a Republican town, and it's the company owned the just owned the town. And you couldn't do anything unless, well, just like I said, otherwise you lost your job in the mill. And then the conditions in the mill, different working conditions, and the way they treated the people. That's the reason why the people revolted and they start forming the union.
Did you ever lose your job or did
you? There were friends of mine that had lost jobs. I was called in by management and told that if I misbehaved myself, that I would be unemployed because I was starting to get active in the Christian fraternal movement in our Christian community life.
Croatian?
Yes, community life. Yeah. To emphasize that, I am now president of the Christian Center in Alcoa, and I have been active since 1933 in the Christian community, Christian activities in the Alcoa and Tri-State and throughout the nation.
See, he lived in Rockstown, where one section of the people lived. I lived on Plan 11 up on top of the hill here.
East Italian,
Then what they did, like our dad used to make wine, things like that. Well, if somebody would turn you in, they'd come up there and they search your house, and if you had two or three barrels of wine down there, they'd shoot at it with a gun and make it drain down your cellars. And they mistreated the people here.
Now, who were they?
Well, the town police, because the Burgess was Republican, and they did everything the company told them to do, because we had a lot of stool pigeons here in this town. And they were trying to organize, and we had an Italian club up there, the MPI club. And we got people in there, we started organizing, and they knew about it, and they knew who the people were. And then we had different Italian people that were moving along with the company, and went down and reported them, and picked them back up, and it turned one against the other.
It sounds like your ethnic activities were connected with your labor organizing.
No, we were segregated. Segregation was so bad that my parents never learned English. His parents never learned English because they lived in the Serbian community, and we spoke and we act and we met in all our activities. His people, Eddie's people, were Italian people. They spoke Italian, and very few of them learned to be Americanized because they were still living within, like, New York, but they were living in America. So it wasn't the matter that the Croatian people had to be Italian people. The only way we could communicate would be to learn the English language. And we weren't learning the English language. We were learning, keeping our own languages in our segregated areas. And then when this got too bad in Alcoa, we finally realized that something has to be done. The new generation, the one that I come from, we went to American school, we were taught the American Constitution, we were taught we had certain freedoms and we didn't have them.
What school did you go to?
Alcoa School, Lockstown School, and Alcoa Public Schools. And then there was nothing. I went to work in a steel mill at the age of 14. Our people, myself and my brothers and my friends and Eddie, we were all hired at a very young age because we were productive with young people. So the result was that when the Great Depression came out, we found that in the borough of Alcoa, although we were the ethnic people, did not go on relief. They learned to live within their means. They used to have their own gardens. Some of them raised their own chicken. We even were allowed to have little hogs in the back of the houses. And some of them had even a barn for a cow. And we learned the Depression to be not dependable on relief, but to depend on each other to survive the Depression. And we did. And working, so the relief program in Alcoa is very limited. And when they did give you something in Alcoa, on relief, then they send you out to work for 50 cents a day. So if you got $3 relief, you got 6 days of work.
Who administered that relief?
That question was, nobody knew who administered it. All we were told that you just put, it was the Burr trucks that took us to work, it was the Burr equipment that took us to work, it was the foreman of the mill that told you where to go, and you could never find out where you had to write it.
We used to call that Paul Morris Farmer one time.
Yeah, like PM4.
We lived down to Golf Course Road out there, and we built that. My dad was supposed to go out because he was old, so I used to go out in this place. And then he used to give you a little certificate. He used to go down to the cutlery store, and he used to give you a flour, potatoes, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the flour was all wormy-like. You know, when he gave it to you, because it came in boxcars and stuff like that. So we'd take it up to my cousin. He used to feed the hogs, and then he used to give us a little bit of milk and things like that for the exchange.
J&L, the
man that administrated, in my knowledge, was the captain of the J&L police force.
You know his name?
Paul Mock. I forget what it's Paul. His last name was Mock. I forget his first name.
Is that M-A-U-C-K?
M-A-U-K.
M-O-C-K.
M-A-U-K.
M-O-C-K.
So when you talk about the labor history, you have to look in the reasons behind it. If you had an affair, a wedding, you had to get permission from the police department to have a wedding.
So people could congregate.
If you had our fraternal organizations, we had a dance. We had to go to the police station to get permission for a dance, and at 12 o'clock the police would come in and tell you to go home. You couldn't stay after 1 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Whenever they decided that you could.
What were some of the other ethnic organizations?
Well, you had the colored people, then you had the Slovenians, and they had the Croatians, you had the Italians, and the Greek Orthodox. But then they had us all separate.
And the one time the Hungarian community was a large Hungarian community here, but it finally dissolved. The Hungarians were the most effective. They had the first hall in Alcoa, but they were the first to dissolve among themselves, and they became Americanized, and that took a while. But there's still some, the ethnic groups, the Polish group used to be real strong at the one time. We had a strong Polish community here. But now the strong ethnic community at the present time is the Italians and the Croatians and the Serbians, which is about, and the Slovaks, which is about the four ethnic groups that are strong. Then you have the other smaller ones in between. So when you talk about labor history, I didn't think that you should go about labor history to know the background and the reasons for it to arise in our problem.
You know, they got to give company credit. One time they turned around where Limoir Plan was at up on top of the hill here. They gave all that ground was empty, so they gave it to the people, and people used to go out to make their gardens during the Depression. We used to go up there and dig it and plant potatoes and plant beans. We used to walk from Plant 11 up there. And then the older fellows used to make little shanties like he used to do in the old country, so he could put the tools there, so they didn't have to carry them on their shoulders back and forth with watering cans.
To survive the Depression and keep the people busy now, J&L took the island. The ground was undeveloped, and state that I like a piece a lot.
Yeah, what's that equipment?
They gave piece a lot. The 80 years number 17, mine is number 18, and it was say 50 by 100, whatever was the size I could kind of get. And then they gave you the seeds that you went out and planted. The only thing I got disgusted when I planted my garden, I went to pick it up. Somebody beat me in the morning, and some of my neighbors came and picked my crop up, and I didn't have any.
In West Alacoque, what they did, see, right before they built this BOF down there, there used to be a separation between the land and the island. Well, so J&L went down and they put three barges together. They tied them together, and people used to walk through these barges, go on the other side, and they used to do it, you know, at the garden, like my father-in-law and the rest of the people down. See, most of West Alacoque, they were all Republicans down there at one time. And then they still are. They were all mostly company people. And we have to see that they had their own mayor, they had their own police chief and everything down there.
Until 28.
They used to be West Alacoque.
Used to be
Alacoque. Used to be Alacoque. We used to be Woodlawn. And then they changed the name, and those people down there were mad because they had to be under our supervision.
How did the name Alacoque win out?
What do you mean?
The name Alacoque.
The Alacoque is, West Alacoque was Alacoque, and the history goes back that there was an Indian queen by the name of Alacoque. And Woodlawn was Woodlawn because when J&L came into Alacoque, they went down the river that was all wood. The wooded area when they started building their plant, so they called it Woodlawn. There was a park. There used to be a park. Where J&L plant is now, there, in the 1900s, there was a pavilion there in a park, and that was where it started. So Woodlawn. And then in 1928, we merged West Alacoque and Woodlawn and came up with Alacoque and West Alacoque. It came under.
See, I wondered why the name Alacoque stuck instead of the name Woodlawn.
Because the Queen Alacoque of the Indians was a historical name.
You don't think it was because somebody wanted Alacoque rather than Woodlawn?
Well, they voted on that, and that's what they didn't want out, because the people down there thought Alacoque didn't have that name. Well, that place is pretty well occupied for that time.
How do people think of West Alacoque today? Do they think of it as part of the whole
thing? No, West Alacoque, for some reason, even today, feels that they are one of their own yet. They are still the town of their own. When we played politics, West Alacoque, you never know how they're going in an election because they are still like little, the older people are still there and the young generation has moved out. So the people that are living in West Alacoque are mostly the older generation who's been there 30, 40, 50, 60 years, some of them. But West Alacoque, when you wait for the election returns, they vote, you never can tell if they vote as the rest of the town. They still vote as though they're a little town by themselves. And
J&L one time wanted to change that town. They wanted to buy the whole town out. And the people refused. They wanted to build them a new town up on top where the water tanks are, right above Monaco Road there. Mm-hmm. And they turned it down. So now they've got their home down. If you sell a home, they make you take everything out of it and then they demolish it.
Who does?
The company.
The company.
You can't sell it to an individual. Say you can if you will, but if they give it to the company pays you so much for it. And then they let you take all the plumbing and everything you want out of it. And then they tear it down and they send a bulldozer in there and they level it all off. And then that's the reason our taxes are going higher all the time, because see, they demolish a lot of homes in Alacoque.
See, in West Alacoque.
And that's why our taxes are pretty high here now, because I bet they demolish maybe 100, 150 homes out of Alacoque. Maybe even more, and that tax is coming into the borough.
So what, see, West Alacoque usually is the old folks. When the old folks die off, the young people are living in Ambridge or around today.
Excuse me, I'm hearing you. Yeah. I didn't realize you were.
And then the inheritance comes into the children, and they want to sell. So they can't sell, the corporation will buy at a reasonable price, so they sell it to the corporation, as Eddie says.
Nobody wants to live down there.
Then the corporation
the mill's
tears
right
down.
There in your backyard.
Does the mill plan to expand down there? Does the mill plan to expand down there?
Yes.
Well, naturally. That's what they do. I don't know if they're going to expand now because they're shutting a lot of things down.
With let's say this, our historical background, before LTV came in the picture, we had seen that J&L was an expandable industry in Aricopa because of its location, being on river bank and the security of the plant. For example, you go to the Franklin Avenue Tunnel, and you go to West Aricopa, we used to have a tunnel, and they put a bridge, but you go through the bridge, so you have to an entrance down in the Sound Heights Tunnel, and the overhead bridge, and the plant with the railroad in between, the security is there, the plant is protected and it's laid out, and then the transportation of steel. They make the raw steel in the North Mill, and they make the billets, for example, and send it to the seamless and make pipe. They make the coils and send them to the tin mill and make tin, make coils. And so the cost of transportation of the mill is economically one of the most economical of all, with the exception that LTD now came in and is not reinvesting their earnings back into this mill. They're taking their earnings here and they're buying into other branches, branching out of steel. They may be going into oil. They may be going into repacking, maybe going into shopping centers, and they're not putting their money back in Aricopa, and it's showing to show its effect that Aricopa is deteriorating because our equipment is old. We cannot compete with the world steel industry with the equipment that we have compared to the new equipment that's being built in European countries. Example, we have trained people in our plants here. I've helped to train Italian people, and we built a new Italian plant in Italy, a pipe mill in Italy by the Italians. They now have a better mill than the one I taught them on, and they're more productive and better quality.
I just came from there, and they're putting up plants here just like mushrooms. They've grown everywhere. And for a little country like that, I'm surprised, because I even hate to say this about this country-wise, because here, they're just shutting plants down back and forth. And they've got to start looking some other way of getting things working out, because it looked pretty bad for us. Now, I was down Sears Roebuck the other day, and they had boxes and boxes of boots, $10 off, all made in Korea. Ladies' shoes made in Korea. You take men's shirts, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and I'm telling you, this country is just going bad to worse right now. I just don't like the looks of it, because what I've seen over there, those people are progressing, and we're going the other way.
I wanted to really concentrate on the 1930s, and I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned the company store. I wanted to ask you a little more about that. Did you shop there yourselves?
Yes, ma'am.
How did you pay? Did you pay cash, or?
We paid to, you just give me a check number.
There were several ways to buy. If you were buying groceries and you were buying a small quantity, you could get coupon books. So a coupon for $5, $10, $15. Or you could buy by charge. Now, if you got a big bill, you charged and you got a big bill and you felt delinquent in your payments as we went to the profession, then they cut you off. Then to control you, they gave you coupon books. So you came in and you wanted to buy as much as you want. No, you could always have $15 just to pay. And that's all you got, coupon books. Because once you became, weren't able to have enough earnings to pay your bill. We've had people who at one time, I had a friend of mine worked with me, owed as high as $900 the company store, and he was then limited to his purchases, I think, to 2 months, and then he had some difficulties, and his home broke up, and then this regrouping. There was also some misuse in the coupon system. A lot of people bought coupons, and they wanted, for example, to have some refreshments of going to some bars and drinking. And some of the barkeepers would take the coupons, and then they would be able to buy the coupons. But this, and this coupon question became very serious when one of the bar in a town that I remember real well, went in and had enough coupons to buy a whole living room outfit, which wasn't the intent of the coupons. So you purchased both ways. Your rent, one thing we have to give credit, but the company did not evict anyone for delinquency of rent, as long as you was on the payroll. Now, we were on the payroll in 1933. I would work an average of 1 day every 3 weeks. I earned a total earnings in 1933 of $308. And I lived, and I was married, one child, but my mother owned the home that I rented, and my mother had some money saved up, so she carried my load through the Depression time. Example, how we would live, we would butcher a big hog, 400 or 500 pounds, we made our own sausages, our own ham, well, we bought a cabbage, we used to dance the cabbage with bare feet, make 50-gallon cabbage, we used to buy beans, and our menus was consisting of the European tradition of feeding the family. By the European tradition, I mean, was we didn't have the cereals. My cereal in the morning was my homemade bread with coffee in a big bowl.
And they put milk in it, then you add water to it in a big bowl, and then they used to give it to you.
Or in the morning, we had cornmeal, and we made the cornmeal mush, and broke it off, and that was my cereal. And my evening meal was consisting of sauerkraut and beans, a little piece of meat. My 1933 Christmas, I never forgot. Dinner was 2 pounds of pork chops for 25 cents. I couldn't afford chicken. I couldn't afford anything else. 2 pounds of pork chops with some sauerkraut and so forth. This was my Christmas dinner in 1933. This is the way we were in the Depression time. As the things got better, we then realized that we needed something, so we first rebellion we had was 1932. In fact, Eleanor Roosevelt ran for president. This town in Alperpump, you worked in the mill. The foreman came down the mill, the car came on a job, took you out and told you you could have voted Republican. If you were a citizen or not a citizen, you voted.
You were 21 or not. I was 18 when they took me out and made me vote.
As long as you was on the payroll, I had people who couldn't speak and explain to you the English language, and they came to one of the men and says to him to go to vote. He says, he couldn't say citizen. He says, I know city man. No, can't go. Superintendent looked at the roll call. He says, you go ahead and vote. So in the town of Alcrimpon, despite the fact in 32 we were told to vote, the town started to vote against the company in silence. Then the second rebellion grew strong. It worked in Roosevelt time, then Roosevelt came in, then he established the ERA, which controlled the work and set up rules. And then they were starting to set up the National Labor Relations Act, which was passed by Congress.
That ERA, was that company union?
Yeah.
Okay. Employee Representation Act.
Mm-hmm. No, there was an ERA, was a law that designated 8 hours a day of work, overtime for over 40 hours. There was a law passed to control the working hours. Now, we would work in the mill here. It's double, triple, 50 hours a week, 70 hours a week. You never got overtime. You could get a little controlling. But the government under Roosevelt started to set up rules of the rights of employers and employees when you get time and a half. And this was the ERA. And then the ERP, employees representative, the ERP was the company union. ERA was a federal law to start controlling, because many places were still working 10, 12, 14 hours a day, and they made it 8 hours a day, the ERA. And that was some help. In 36, when we started organizing the unions, we had the employees, ERP, Employees Representation Fund. So when the Wagner Act was passed, the company then came in, this foreman called all of our people together and says, you have a right to a union, you have a right to elect your representatives. We have no right to call a meeting outside of the plan. We have no right to preside at the meeting. The general foreman, the superintendent, assistant superintendent presided at the meeting. Then they had an election in the mill, and then you voted.
Who was the general superintendent?
Well, we had, we talked about plant manager. In this plant, we had maybe 10 superintendents and a plant manager, you understand? So each department has a plant department superintendent and a plant manager.
At that time, it was Saxer?
Let's see. Was it Saxer? Yeah. No, it was the fellow who became president of Republic Steel.
I thought he was here in the 20s, but Tom Berger.
Then there's a fellow by the name of White, plant manager, and he went with Tom Berger later. But anyway, it could have been Saxer.
Then there's another one, Martin.
I think
Martin
Saxer
came
was
in later.
I think Saxer was here at the time he was, So as we developed the ERP, who were against the ERP, if we didn't go to vote, we were in trouble. We were scared to lose our jobs.
So the department done, maybe go and vote.
But what we would do, we underground meant that we had little stickers. And those that we could trust, we would give them stickers and say, when you go to vote, put in, I want a union. And we had stickers, or we would be blank, wouldn't vote at all. They would never give the results of how many votes were cast and how many votes, say 1,000 votes cast. This man got 800. These are winners and these are losers. And the company then put these ERP people on their payroll. And they pay them Francis Bates, who was one of them, he turned in 26 hours for 24-hour work. They were allowed so much travel time. The company said, how come you get paid for 26 hours when you only get 24 hours in a day? Well, he says, I'm allowed 2 hours for this, and 2 hours for this, and 3 hours for this, and you got them all together. 26 hours. But these people, then they controlled the control of the ERP people. So when we start organizing the union, we had the Amalgamated Association of Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers of America, which originated with the hot mill people.
With what?
The hot mill, where they made tin plate.
He worked in the welder. Yeah. He worked in the welder, too.
And the reason that it does, because in Newcastle, they had a hot mill and they had a union, Amalgamated Association of Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers of America. But when that Newcastle plant shut down, J&L hired a lot of people from Newcastle, and these people were still union-minded, and they worked for J&L, and then the movement started going down in that area, and then it started going throughout the plant. And then we were having many, many of our people discharged because they showed interest in the union. And when it came here in Alcoa, we finally broke quiet. Then we were Alabama Association of Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers of America. And then we rebelled against them. And under Leonard, I forget his. We rebelled against him because we couldn't get no action from the leadership of the Amalgamated Association of Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers of America.
Was that the rank and file movement?
This one. We had several meetings in Canonsburg in this area, and we started to work. And Alcoa chapter, we call it chapters at that time, we didn't call them locals. Alcoa chapter at that time was very aggressive in the movement. And then John L. Lewis broke away the American Federation of Labor Convention, and him and Hutchison had a real fight in the punch out. And then they came into Pittsburgh and they organized the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and I happened to be at that meeting. It was organized in the Grotto Auditorium in Pittsburgh.
What auditorium?
Grotto, Grotto Auditorium up in North Sinai. Mm-hmm. And we organized it. And then they designated Philip Query to be chairman, steel working, Bittner, Van Bittner, and Golden. And then McDonald was just a young man, Dave McDonald. He was a young fella, worked for a while in steel mill, and his Haig's father and Philip Murray were good friends. So when the time came up, he wanted young Haig to be his secretary. Philip Murray didn't believe in a female secretary. He wanted a male secretary. So Dave McDonald became just a secretary to Philip Murray while he was vice president of the United Mine Workers. So when they were organizing the steel workers organizing committee, they took Dave McDonald with Philip Murray because he was the fellow who did all the paperwork for Philip Murray. And this is how Dave McDonald got involved. And then Philip Murray, then we broke away from the Amalgamated Association of Iron, Steel and Tin Workers, and we supported the steel workers organizing committee. And we brought into Al Kripa many of our organizers. For example, we had Smiley Chaddick, who was a Bulgarian that ties into Slav language. We had the Buzzarellas, who were Italian people. We had Morris Malinger, who was a Jewish fellow, came to amalgamate clothing workers. We had Joe Temple, who became the district director of a Slav movement. And they were bringing in other groups, so they knew that people in Al Kripa couldn't understand always the leadership talking, so they depended on the ethnic groups. And many times I would go to a meeting, and then when the meeting was over, I would get up, and after the meeting was over, I would get up and explain why, what was said in the Creation language. Mm-hmm. And we had that little fellow who used to work in the burr, I forget his name. He'd get up in Italian language, and we had Dominic Brandy, this Italian fellow who would do that, and so forth. So this is where we started the organizations, and then we were very well intimidated during that period. But John Topolsky, who was also came in, was a Slav leader, and he was an organizer. And when John Topolsky came into town, we had a fellow, I kind of forget his name now. They even put one of our members, who was an organizer, they put him in a mental institution, says that he was mentally insane. Usoski, his name is Usoski, George Usoski.
That discouraged the people.
So this fellow, at that time, he just disappeared from home. And we spent about 2 weeks that we located in a mental institution, and we had the governor of the state of Pennsylvania release him. Governor Earl released him from the mental institution, and he wasn't mentally insane. He was one of the fellows who went out and opened. So our people lost their jobs in Alcapa, and then we challenged the reality of the Wagner Act. With 10 original people. There were 10, there were more than 10 fired, but we selected 10 who were willing to stand up and testify. You know, you can get 100 people fired, but then even though they're fired, the fear was still in them. So the 10 people that testified, and if you look at the roster of the 10 people down by the Y, there's a plaque with all the names on it. And if you look at the name, you'll not find any particular ethnic group, should find a mixture of all, with the exception of a black.
Those were all personal friends of ours.
Yeah.
What about the black people? Were they involved in the regional organizing too?
No, they were more afraid than we were.
The blacks were, the corporation used the blacks to break the unions. But there were several black leadership, such as James Downing and Mason and a few others, who were not intimidated. And in the original strike of 37, we had rumors on the picket line that the blacks were going to go to the company to work. So we went out to the woods. We had no guns or ammunition. We went to the woods and we took our axes and we came back with limbs the size of baseball bats or a little longer, and we had about 200 of them laying along the walk waiting for if the battle came on, we were going to fight. James Downing and Mason, who were two blacks that were very interesting organization, said this will never happen. Our blacks are not going to come down, and they disappeared for about 15 hours. I lost contact with them for 15 hours. And 15 hours later, James Downing came back and walked around Mason, and we were looking at our clubs and saying, hey, make sure our clubs is in order so everything is organized. We all waited. And Jim Downing told me personally, he says, I don't know what you're waiting for. He says, my blacks are not. He didn't use the word blacks at that time. At that time it was the word niggers. My niggers buddies are not coming down. They never showed up. So I guess, despite the fact that there were people encouraging them to break the strike, there were certain black elements in their leadership who discouraged them.
They didn't trust each other either, you think like in our department, I had a list, you had to pay your own union dues at that time. Because after the union organized. And some of these fellows were afraid to go and even be seen near the union hall. So I used to carry 10 cards in my pocket. These used to be money on payday, and I used to pay the union dues for it. Because they wouldn't give it to some of their individuals because they were afraid they wouldn't be turned
in.
And
that was after we got, then in, we came in 36, 37, we got our original strike. You heard about that. And we pulled. To give you an example, how in our mills, our people were going to blow the furnaces up, wreck to control the mills, and it took those of us who were very active in the union to go back to our rank and file and say, don't tear the house down because you need it. And this was the thing we were scared of when the 37th strike came on. We were scared that our people would start vandalism in the mill and turn the equipment down. So our big job was the day of the strike to tell them don't do it. So when I was in the mill, I worked that night the strike was on. And the superintendent came to me and he says, well, they're going to shut the mill down, they're going to blow up the line. I says, just come with me and talk to them. And I said, I'm not allowed to. This is my job. If I get off the job, you'll fire me, but I quit my job. I went on strike ahead of time. I'm not going to permit you to do it. And he begged me to finally go with him. And I says, then I had Clifford Brown, the black fellow, witness. I said, you witnessed this, that I'm going at the request of the superintendent. And I went to the mill and told our people, don't damage the equipment, nothing. And I was almost one of the last half a dozen people who walked out of the mill, and the superintendent at that time shook hands with me and they thanked me for going too, because it was our job to realize, to train our people who were not new in the union, don't rent the place because as soon as the strike is settled, we want to go back to work. And then we did go on strike and then fight hot and heavy. The police force under Ambrose came down and was sending people to corporations started to get stuff into the mills to the mill, and our pickets being unprepared took the mill truck and stopped it. It was illegal. It was a violation of the law. But because we were so interested in winning them, we weren't going to get them again. But the leadership of the top leadership who came in settled down our pickets, told the mail truck